Birth, the Grand Division, Chapter 3. There has never been a female chief of staff for a president. President Robert Riker had to adapt quickly after the recent attempt on his life at Site R, just outside of Camp David. He didn't know who could be trusted. Margaret was very good at scheduling things and keeping it from being interrupted, but there were new demands on the office of the president that needed someone intuitive and tuned into the higher frequencies of the higher earth. Besides, she was inherited from the previous administration. The team that came together a few months ago, under the strangest of circumstances, to begin saving the world, was remarkable in all their varied talents. But none of them had to deal with the dark powers that circled the White House these days. He needed someone who was courageous and cool and yet disarmingly charming. He needed someone who had highly developed powers of discernment and yet a working knowledge of the protocols for domestic and international diplomacy. "I really need my wife," he said, as he considered who in the world could do this job. But she had passed after a short and nearly painless encounter with cervical cancer the year before he considered his independent run for the presidency. He went through the list of men suggested by the joint transition team made of senators and congressmen who wanted things to go along, as they always had. He spent the last few evenings with his direct online access to the Library of Congress. Secret Service Agent Smith was on an extended convalescent absence to recover from his gunshot wound after General Cabarrus had gunned him down in the lightning-fast battle inside Site R. He would still require a few surgeries before the collarbone could be reconstructed and the therapy could be completed. More than likely, he would never be assigned to presidential duty again, but all that remained to be seen. He currently spent his time between the UCLA Medical Center and Westwood, the beach running or walking, and sharing his life with Bette Dyson. She was soon to become Mrs. Michael Smith as she continued her path to a PhD in geology at Caltech in Pasadena, California, under the auspices of Loretta Wesson. He was glad Caltech responded quickly to his commendation letter on her behalf and made her a full professor with tenure. She was also heading up his JPL team in Pasadena for figuring out ways to measure the dissolution of the Union of the Polarity, which promised cataclysms to the physical planet. It would be nice to be able to evacuate people when and where it was needed to save lives. Hadid accompanied him almost everywhere these days. He and Secret Service Agent Jones were the only two men he truly trusted. He told them one night as they came from a meeting at the Pentagon, "You know, I could sleep when the wind blows with you guys around." "I am familiar with desert winds, but I don't know what this means, Mr. President," said Hadid. So the story goes, a farmer wanted to hire a hand to keep things in good working order. He was told that when the wind blows, the horses will get scared and run around and could get seriously hurt or killed running into a fence or a piece of farm equipment that had often stayed parked near the barn. He was supposed to make sure the tools were put up, the barn windows secured, and the horses put into their stalls in the barn at night. During the job interview, he simply replied to each question about his abilities that he could sleep when the wind blows. Well, one night the wind came up fiercely and looked like it carried lightning with it somewhere in the distance. Awakened by the sudden noise, the farmer went to the back door and yelled out to the farmhand's cottage, but the lights were out, and there was no sign of his farmhand. So the farmer, fuming that he probably would fire the man in the morning, put on his overalls and boots and ran out to the barn. To his amazement, the tools were all hanging in their place, the windows were latched, and the horses were in their stalls with fresh straw and a tub of clean water. It was then that he understood what the farmhand meant when he said he could sleep when the wind blows. "That is a very nice story, Mr. President. Is it true?" asked Hadid. "Of course it's true," smiled Riker. "I heard almost that same story. I think it is true," added Jones. As the limousine came to a stop outside the White House motor pool deck, Riker looked across to his two most trusted agents. "Gentlemen, I need to find a farmhand." "Chief of Staff?" asked Jones. Riker smiled. I've been researching the origins of that position, and I discovered some very dark and terrible things. I kind of feel like Lincoln when he had received word of some of the terrible things his generals were doing to the American people to win the war. "I'm sure he said many things, Mr. President," said Hadid. Lincoln said, "You know, Colonel, I used to have a wonderful cabin with the most majestic oak tree near the front porch. One day I saw a squirrel run across the front lawn and leap to the side of that old tree. He ran up the side of that tree and right down inside that giant trunk. I knew then that the tree was hollow and would one day fall on that cabin and destroy it." Riker went on with his story, but he paused and waited to see the curiosity in his agents. "You know what I wished, Colonel?" asked Lincoln. "No, Mr. President. What did you wish?" asked the colonel. "I wished I'd never seen that squirrel," finished Riker. Riker reached for the door handle, but Jones was quicker and smoothly opened the door and stepped out into the evening air, instinctively looking around for danger. Riker stood out of the limousine with Hadid right behind him. The three men walked in silence to the White House and entered through the rear kitchen door. "Hungry?" asked Riker. "No, sir," they both said. "Well, I'm making a sliced pastrami sandwich and heading for my bedroom with a cold beer. I'll see you in the morning." Riker was a sandwich craftsman, and sometimes, to the chagrin of his master White House chef, he made his own. As he spread the spicy mustard over the marbled rye bread kept just for him in the White House bread box, he was lost, deep in thought, and reflected about the information he had uncovered while he was searching for guidance on filling the position of chief of staff. He was still thinking about a female for that role. His own election was the strangest event in history. While the great powers that choose presidents prepared their actors and considered their teleprompter skills, their hairlines, and their heights, they overlooked one thing. They failed to take into account the egos of the men inside those suits. As the final nominees for both parties squared off for a series of debate shows before the American public, they had a physical fight on national television. Oh, the directors tried to cut away, but thousands of cell phones recorded and shared the most horrible spectacle, complete with bloody noses and shouted vulgarities. Riker's campaign was viral, online, and he never attended any of the debates. He simply answered every debate question with YouTube videos, and the social networks did the rest. He was the first write-in candidate to win the election. More than 50 million people wrote his name in, and the great powers lost control of the office of the president. Now, he had to think of how to address the office of chief of staff. As it turns out, it was an immensely powerful and influential role. He said, chewing a bite of his pastrami on rye with spicy mustard and a swallow of beer. He read and clicked with the remote mouse resting in the arm of the chair. The office was started in 1939 by President Franklin D. Roosevelt. The duties of the White House Chief of Staff vary greatly from one administration to another, and in fact, there's no legal requirement that the president even fill the position. However, since at least 1979, all presidents have found the need for a chief of staff, who typically oversees the actions of the White House staff, manages the president's schedule, and decides who is allowed to meet with the president. Because of these duties, the chief of staff has at various times been labeled the gatekeeper, or the power behind the throne. Lewis McHenry Howe was the first to hold the office, formed by Franklin D. Roosevelt, but it was actually Harry Hopkins who became his closest confidant. Harry's 1939 diagnosis of stomach cancer seemed to help him bond to the wheelchair-bound president. One night, after having dinner with Harry at the White House, he asked him to stay the night in one of the many guest bedrooms. He did not leave the White House for 3.5 years. Although paper trails led to Hopkins as the architect of most of the major reforms in the United States, he became known in the inner circles as the co-president. It was ostensibly clear that government disrefined and finished at the onset was crafted long ago and with the darkest of intentions. Roosevelt's rise to power was auspicious. In 1932, it was the conservative John Nance Garner, also known as Cactus Jack, who ran for the Democratic presidential nomination. It became evident that Franklin D. Roosevelt, then the flamboyant and nationally recognized governor of New York, had the lead in delegate count by 100 votes, but he still lacked the two-thirds required for nomination. No one wanted the convention to be brokered where a mob of delegates can be bribed, threatened, and even otherwise forced to select a nominee that was not selected by the people. Instead of facing that prospect, Garner cut a deal with Roosevelt, becoming his vice presidential candidate. During the same election, Garner was reelected to the 73rd Congress on November 8, 1932. He was the second man, after Schuyler Colfax, to serve as both Speaker of the House and President of the Senate. Garner was reelected Vice President with Roosevelt in 1936, serving in that office in total from March 4, 1933 to January 20, 1941. Like most vice presidents in this era, Garner had little to do and little influence on the president's policies. He famously described the vice presidency as being not worth a bucket of warm piss. During Roosevelt's second term, Garner's previously warm relationship with the president quickly soured as Garner's conservative side told him that an overpowerful central government feeding and taking care of so many citizens would soon be a very bad thing for the nation. There was something dark and sinister about the agencies being set up, funded, and given authority to write laws without congressional involvement. Garner supported a balanced federal government and opposed the Judiciary Reorganization Bill of 1937 to pack the Supreme Court with additional judges, and opposed executive interference with the internal business of the Congress. He tried many times to warn Roosevelt that Harry was behind the scenes. Remaking America into a Marxist regime without end, Roosevelt seemed to ignore Garner and let Harry invent and implement the agency government that would rule the entire country by using the vague language in the Constitution regarding the president's cabinet. During 1938 and 1939, numerous Democratic Party leaders urged Garner to run for president in 1940. Garner was the champion of the traditional Democratic Party establishment, which often clashed with supporters of Roosevelt's New Deal. The Gallup poll showed that Garner's plan had one assumption that would make it work. Roosevelt would not run for a third term, which was customary since George Washington. He miscalculated the avarice of Harry Hopkins. Garner declared his candidacy. Roosevelt's cards were held close to the vest. At the 1940 Democratic National Convention in Chicago Stadium, Harry's dark plan would unfold. Kentucky Senator Alban Barkley read Harry's dictation on behalf of Roosevelt on the first day of the convention. "The president has never had, and has not today, any desire or purpose to continue in the office of president, to be a candidate for that office, or to be nominated by the convention for that office. He wishes in earnestness and sincerity to make it clear that all of the delegates in this convention are free to vote for any candidate," stated Senator Barkley, pausing after each key phrase to compensate for the arena's echo. The darkness of this craft to seize an unprecedented third-term presidency was stunning beyond measure. It was apparent to Riker that Semyaza's agent, secretly and carefully attached to Roosevelt, was truly gifted. When the senator finished reading that statement, the convention sat in shocked silence for a moment. On the one hand, Roosevelt was saying he had no intention or desire to be nominated. On the other hand, he told the delegates to vote for whoever they wanted. They did not know what to do. The dichotomy of the moment was too much to bear. Riker was sure Semyaza knew he had already seized the most powerful nation on Earth from the inside. He also knew the American people were addicted to the wealth and necessity of a powerful and wealthy central government. Riker could tell 1940 Democrats. Riker could tell 1940 Democrat delegates were happy with the way things were, as they each had become wealthy while the rest of the society remained soaked in poverty. What became clear as he read the biographies and largely ignored history of this denial of a popular election by sinister forces was that all these indoctrinated cronies needed was a push. Riker knew that Harry would mastermind the manipulation of the American army and the Allied armies and navies to facilitate the Soviet takeover of Eastern Europe. He had also single-handedly created the rise of the Third Reich. He was crafting and implementing the Lend-Lease program that eventually would meticulously ship everything the Soviets would need to make their own nuclear weapons, using the U.S. military as a transportation company right under the nose of the president. He would even implicate the husband and wife Jewish spies, the Rosenbergs, and witness their execution for the crime for which they were falsely accused. With Semyaza's ageless wisdom to guide him, surely he could manipulate the 1940 Democrat Convention and continue his reign of global terror against the free and independent peoples of the earth and slavery for the working poor for his master. Riker read on. Suddenly, a loud voice came booming over the stadium's loud system. "We want Roosevelt. We want Roosevelt." Harry's Chicago crime boss, Mayor Ed Kelly, had ordered Thomas D. Gary, superintendent of Chicago's Department of Sanitation, to conduct the stunt from a well-guarded basement room with a connected microphone. Strategically placed throughout the stadium were hundreds of Democratic bosses, trusted city workers, and precinct captains, all coached to keep the contagion going. Whenever the chant began to die down, state chairmen, who also had microphones connected to the speakers, added their own endorsements. New Jersey wants Roosevelt. Arizona wants Roosevelt. Iowa wants Roosevelt. Harry's genius was flawless, winning Roosevelt 86% of the vote in the first count without a single regard for Washington's tradition. Garner got only 61 votes out of 1,093. Harry Hopkins then advised Roosevelt to obfuscate Garner and select a strong liberal who would go along with his policies. Henry Wallace of Iowa was vigorously opposed by conservative Democrats who could see the country sinking into endless debt. But at the last, Wallace was elected as vice president. The agency government was growing in power and involvement in the world. Within a few months, the Hitler Hopkins had painstakingly created for Semyaza was ready. His test of the Blitzkrieg method of warfare had been successfully tested with a 3-day massacre of Guernica in Spain. Stuka Ju-87 dive bombers were coordinated with mechanized units using tanks, armored half-tracks, and automatic weapons to wipe out the town as a show of support for the fascist President Franco. Billionaire industrialists like Alcoa and Ford Motor Company had trained Hitler's manufacturing companies and supplied key technologies and materials to allow Germany to emerge from the Great Depression unscathed and in total control of the banks that had saddled the country with untenable reparations as the first phase of Semyaza's plan to engulf the entire war was carried out. Adolf Hitler himself awarded the Grand Cross of the Golden Eagle in 1938 to Henry Ford for his priceless assistance in building the Third Reich. The players were in place. The world's population was fast asleep, either going to bed hungry for lack of food and clean water, are going to bed fat on the profits from preparing to make war. Those who would profit from war planned their lives of luxury and power, as was promised by the oldest and most evil life form on earth. The working poor had little choice but to enlist in the military when the call to arms would be made. January 20, 1941, Roosevelt gave his inaugural address. Little more than 11 months later, America would suffer a planned attack at Pearl Harbor. Most of the American Navy was wiped out in a few hours because they were all moored together in a single row in the harbor. Weeks before this theatrical massacre of American soldiers, nurses, and civilians, America had declared war against Germany as required by treaty. Truly, the entire world returned to war for another 5 years. There was hardly a part of the plan that was out of place until late in the year 1944. A brilliant and courageous General George S. Patton had battled against the Nazi SS Rommel and succeeded in winning the freedom of North Africa from Nazi control. This effectively cut off the endless fuel supply that kept more advanced planes, faster ships, and even advanced rocketry programs ahead of the world. Patton and his troops and equipment had arrived in Italy. They were intact, well-trained, and motivated by success to finish the war. They were uniquely positioned in Italy to plunge straight to the heart of Nazi Germany by driving up the Rhine River Valley. With the Nazis occupied, with approaching Russian armies to the north, they could not stop Patton if he charged up the center of Europe. Patton was many things, but he was not a follower of Semyaza. Patton made his recommendation known and awaited orders. But when the orders did come, he was shocked to his core. The mission was clear to him that someone at the very highest levels of world government had a far different agenda than that of the warrior he believed he was born to be. The orders even caught the Germans by surprise. Knowing their weakness to the south, they sent hundreds of spies into Italy to find Patton's Third Army. They were captured by the dozens in a state of confusion. Harry had ordered Patton's army to sail out of the Straits of Gibraltar and to head for the west coast of France. Under Harry's orders, the Allies would attack at the most heavily fortified beach possible. Against all odds, they rolled unceasingly toward Berlin, sometimes making 20 miles a day. Their victories were too good and too fast to allow the Soviets time to complete their plan. Harry ordered the armies to halt their advance just 60 miles west of the city in order to give the Soviets a free hand to do as they pleased with half of Europe. Patton was enraged. He had correctly surmised that if they attacked the Soviets immediately, they would decimate them as their supply chain was non-existent. Accused by his contemporaries of being too close to the action to see the big picture, Patton was furious, and he could see Harry's strategy. Perhaps he was the only one who saw it and opposed it openly. He knew that if his forces did not get there first, half of Europe would be seized by the Soviets. He was almost positive Harry Hopkins was a Soviet spy, so close to Roosevelt, now almost a complete invalid, that there was nothing he could do about it. He also knew that the world would be kept at a state of some kind of war for the next 100 years if Harry's plan was allowed to unfold. He resolved to resign rather than to be retired with a gag in his mouth. Semyaza knew his military skills and strategy would never align with him, so he plotted another end for Patton. On December 8, 1945, Patton's chief of staff, Major Hobart Gay, invited him on a pheasant hunting trip near Spetter. He told him the jaunt in the peaceful countryside would make him feel better. At 11:45 on December 9th, Patton and Gay were riding in Patton's 1938 Cadillac Model 75 staff car, driven by Private First Class Horace L. Woodring, when they stopped at a railroad intersection in Mannheim-Kefertal to allow a train to pass. Patton, in a moment of introspection, commented, "How awful war is. Think of the waste." Resuming their drive, Woodring glanced away from the road when a 2.5-ton GMC truck driven by Technical Sergeant Robert L. Thompson, who was en route to a quartermaster's depot, suddenly made a left turn in front of the car. Woodring slammed on the brakes and turned sharply to the left, exposing Patton's door to the heavy steel bumper of the oncoming truck. Woodring, Thompson, and Gay were only slightly injured in the crash, but Patton had not been able to brace in time, smashing his head into the glass partition in the back seat of the car. He began bleeding from a gash to the head, and he was immediately paralyzed, having trouble breathing. Rushed to a nearby hospital in Heidelberg, Patton was discovered to have a compression fracture and dislocation of C3 and C4. He spent the next 12 days in spinal traction in an attempt to relieve the pressure and swelling. But it was too late. Patton was paralyzed from the neck down. All non-medical visitors were forbidden, lest he divulge what he suspected about Harry's diabolical plan. The only communication that survived was when he said, "This is a hell of a way to die." He died in his sleep of pulmonary edema and congestive heart failure about 6 p.m. on December 21st, 1945. The one voice that could have alerted the world to the high-level global plan of endless battles and the plot to take over the United States from within Washington, D.C., was silenced in a most ignominious manner. Patton was not the only one who knew of this plan. The rest of the top military leadership knew all too well what was in store for America. The cost for this conspiracy was higher than anyone could predict. More than 20,000 American and British prisoners of war, once imprisoned in German gulags, were transferred to Soviet camps and lived out their days in captivity, working in mines and forests as slaves. General Dwight D. Eisenhower had direct knowledge that these troops had been enslaved after the war, but he was sworn to secrecy. Semyaza promised him economic prosperity and 2 terms of presidential rule if he would allow the Soviets to capture and hold Europe. He also was required to deny there were any Allied soldiers still in captivity. Riker could not finish his sandwich. That promise, it appears from the absence of history about this terrible betrayal, was kept.